How could her father be so frail? And how could he be so recklessly intent on satisfying his notions of gentlemanliness, hanging his cane on the railing of the stairs so he could, dear God, carry her bag up to her room? But he did it, and then he stood by the door, collecting himself. This is the nicest room, according to Mrs. Blank. He indicated the windows. Cross ventilation, I don't know. They all seem nice to me. He laughed. Well, it's a good house. The house embodied for him the general blessedness of his life, which was manifest, really indisputable, and which he never failed to acknowledge, especially when it stood over against particular sorrow. Even more frequently after their mother died, he spoke of the house as if it were an old wife, beautiful for every comfort it had offered, every grace through all the long years. It was a beauty that would not be apparent to every eye. It was too tall for the neighborhood, with a flat face and a flattened roof and peaked brows over the windows. Italianate, her father said, but that was a guess or a rationalization. In any case, it managed to look both austere and pretentious, despite the porch her father had had built on the front of it to accommodate the local taste for socializing in the hot summer evenings, and which had become overgrown by an immense bramble of trumpet vines. It was a good house, her father said, meaning that it had a gracious heart, however awkward its appearance. And now the gardens and the shrubbery were disheveled, as he must have known, though he rarely ventured beyond the porch. Not that they had been especially presentable even while the house was in its prime. Hide and seek had seen to that, and croquet and badminton and baseball. Such times you had, her father said, as if the present slight desolation were confetti and candy wrappers left after the passing of some glorious parade. And there was the oak tree in front of the house, much older than the neighborhood or the town, which made rubble of the pavement at its foot and flung its imponderable branches out over the road and across the yard, branches whose girths were greater than the trunk of any ordinary tree. There was a torsion in its body that made it look like a giant dervish to them. Their father said if they could see as God can in geological time, they would see it leap out of the ground and turn in the sun and spread its arms and bask in the joys of being an oak tree in Iowa. There had once been four swings suspended from those branches, announcing to the world the fruitfulness of their household. The oak tree flourished still, and of course there had been and there were the apple and cherry and apricot trees, the lilacs and trumpet vines and the daylilies. A few of her mother's irises managed to bloom. At Easter, she and her sisters could still bring in armfuls of flowers, and their father's eyes would glitter with tears, and he would say, "Ah, yes, yes," as if they had brought some memento, these flowers only a pleasant reminder of flowers. Why should this staunch and upright house seem to her so abandoned, so heartbroken? The eye of the beholder, she thought. Still, seven of her father's children came home as often as they could manage to, and telephoned, and sent notes and gifts and crates of grapefruit. Their own children, from the time they could grasp a crayon and scrawl, were taught to remember Grandpa, then Great-Grandpa. Parishioners and their children and grandchildren looked in on her father with a faithfulness that would have taxed his strength if the new minister had not hinted at the problem. And there was Ames, her father's alter ego, in whom he had confided so long and so utterly that he was a second father to them all, not least in the fact of knowing more about them than was entirely consistent with their comfort.